Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lambert and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside Simon Nye is personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And this week, as Simon predicted... held on and on and on. But finally, that most unreliable of boyfriends, Mark Carney, has come good on his hints as interest rates have been raised for the first time in over 10 years, back up to 0.5%. Why did the Bank of England do it? How far and fast will rates continue to go up? And is post-Brexit Britain ready for it? Also, what impact has the era of cheap money had on the economy and our personal finances? There will, of course, be winners. There will definitely be losers. But Simon, ever the optimist, has found three ways to help us get richer, whatever happens next. We are all ears, Simon. Also today, This Is Money gets angry as they investigate the government's shoddy treatment of those looking to boost their state pension. And we delve into the world of Bitcoin. All that and plenty more coming up. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, making saving that little bit more exciting.
But first, after 10 long years, the Bank of England has decided the only way is up for the base rate of interest.
So in many respects, today's decision is straightforward. With inflation high, slack disappearing, and the economy growing at rates above its speed limit, inflation is unlikely to return to the 2% target without some increase in interest rates. Of course, these aren't normal times. Brexit will redefine the UK's relationship with our largest trade and investment partner, and it will have consequences for the movement of goods, services, people, and capital, as well as the real incomes of UK households. The MPC has repeatedly emphasized that monetary policy cannot prevent either the necessary real adjustment to new trading arrangements or the weaker real income growth likely to accompany that adjustment. We can, however, support the economy during the adjustment process. In such exceptional circumstances, the MPC is required to balance any trade-off between the speed at which we return inflation sustainably to target with the support that monetary policy provides to jobs and activity.
The Monetary Policy Committee voted 7-2 to raise it from 0.25% to 0.5%. So we're back to where we were before the post-Brexit emergency cut back in August last year. But why raise rates now? Well, before we get on to some of the winners and the losers, I want to take a trip back in time. Firstly, warm welcome to you both. Pop quiz! Name that song at the start of the show, the year, and for a bonus point, what was the bank rate when it came out?
Okay, that was The Only Way Is Up by Yaz and the Plastic Population.
Oh, he's even got the second part. That's amazing. And you Googled that?
No, I didn't. I just used to read Smash Hits when I was a kid. I reckon it was 1989, and I reckon the bank rate was 12%.
Rachel, to you, the year and the bank rate, he's right on the rest.
I don't know. I mean, I'm going to say early 90s just because I listen to absolute 80s. I don't think that I hear it on it. So I'm going to go for 1990. And the bank rate, oh, it's pretty high then. I don't know, 8.5.
Well, I can tell you that it was 1988. July 1988, yes, Simon.
So close.
I know. And the rate was actually 10.375. I would have taken 9.875 to 10.875. And by the way, it was first released in 1980 by soul singer Otis Clay, and the rate was 16. Anyway, enough of that. Fast forward from 1988 to 2007 this time, when rates last went up. Firstly, what were you doing in 2007, July 2007?
I was mainly writing articles about interest rates having gone up.
Right.
I was working for This Is Money as a reporter, and I, in fact, have one of them in front of me, and I will read you a line from this. Has your mortgage rate risen? 17th of July 2007, that was when that article was last updated. Halifax has raised its standard variable rate by 0.25% to 7.75%. Very different world back then.
Very different world. Rachel, you?
Oh, I wish I could claim the same kind of authority, but I was nowhere near. I was just about to start my master's in journalism, and don't think I was thinking about mortgage rates.
Nor I was actually randomly in South Korea, about to start at The Guardian as a sports reporter in the Northeast. Anyway, enough about that. I want to know what on earth Sir Mervyn King et al. Were doing at the time. What were they thinking that this would achieve? And what has perhaps been the law of unintended consequences? I just want to give us some background, if that's all right, Simon, to where we are now.
Well, in July 2007, the Bank of England raised interest rates for the final time just before the credit crunch hit. And at that point, there was already a certain amount of disquiet, and there was talk about credit crunch already going on, and talk about problems with American subprime mortgages. It hadn't actually properly hit yet. It properly hit over that summer and then into the September. But there was already talk about it, and the word on the street, whatever people were saying in the city, was that Merv was behind the curve. That was the line that everybody was trotting out. That the Bank of England shouldn't have been raising rates, and actually they should have been cutting them. Now, to be fair to Mervyn King, he was someone who was deeply concerned about the amount of debt in the economy, about the unprecedented amount of cheap credit and remortgaging to fuel all those consecutive years of growth that we had, which was kind of built on a foundation of sand. And he was also, when the financial crisis hit, quite worried about moral hazard. And his argument was that we shouldn't give the banks a free pass because effectively that didn't teach anybody any lessons at all. Beyond that point, financial crisis hit, rates were cut very, very rapidly down to 0.5%. They reached that level, I think, in March 2009. And then they sat there until we decided to vote ourselves out of the EU last year. And then we had an emergency cut before we even ever managed to raise them down to 0.25%. And there they remained until Thursday this week, when the Bank of England finally, for the first time in a decade, decided that it could raise interest rates. And it puts us in a uniquely interesting position where the Bank of England delivered what is probably one of the more downbeat inflation reports I've ever read, one of the more downbeat sort of statements around the MPC decision, yet at the same time decided to raise interest rates, which left a lot of people scratching their heads. But I think this one was as much about credibility as anything else.
Well, fast forward again to 2nd of November 2017, announcement by the governor, Mark Carney, followed by that 56-page report, which thankfully, Rachel, you have gone through. It was put out by the bank explaining how it came to its decision. It is, though, Rachel, as you pointed out, riddled, is it not, with convoluted jargon such as non-financial investment grade corporate bond purchases, limited spare capacity and the like. So you've actually done a very handy jargon buster. So in plain English, what on earth are they saying and why have they raised rates now?
Can I say, first of all, that what I've done in this jargon buster is I've gone through the full summary of the report and I've put it into a language that doesn't include stuff like non-financial investment grade corporate bond purchases. And I would say it would be something that the Bank of England maybe should consider doing, because it says in its first paragraph that the reason why it writes the report is, one, to help it make its decisions, and two, because the decisions that it makes affects all of us, and so it wants to share its thinking. And so then why it writes it in language that none of us could understand is beyond me.
They could do two versions, couldn't they?
I think
the original version and then one for...
It wouldn't hurt.
But brilliantly, they do two versions. They do the full report and they do the summary of it as a PDF, which is also completely impenetrable to the normal person.
Maybe three versions then. Okay, so Rachel, could you just explain firstly what a non-financial investment grade corporate bond purchase is?
It's just buying debt off companies, but they have to be good companies, solid ones. You can't just buy off any old company, but you don't want to buy off banks. So it's good, solid companies that aren't banks buying debt off them. That's all it is.
Right. Okay. What else was in there?
So what it does is it sort of lays out its decisions and also sort of how it sees things going in the future. Because the problem is it has to set interest rates, not just for now, but what it sees coming up in the future. And this is always a difficult thing to do, but it is particularly difficult at the moment because there's so much uncertainty. And so it says things like what it's done, it's not quite sure what the outcome will be for Brexit on the economy. So it's gone for the average. It's sort of assumed that things aren't going to be too bad, they're not going to be too good. And then from that, it's built all sorts of models and assessments and decided what to do. But that does kind of mean if it does go one way or the other, then you have to wonder what happens to their predictions.
So will it have the desired effect? I mean, Simon sort of mentioned there that this was perhaps a bit more of a PR or a political decision. There'd been a huge amount of pressure for them to do it with all the hints. The economy's, well, it's not exactly going gung-ho, is it? Let's be honest. What did you say? We're not smashing it. That's what you said last week. I rather like that, Simon. Employment, though, that's doing well. But we're still in the middle of Brexit negotiations.
Yes. So the bank's economists are worried about Brexit, the negotiations around it, the confidence-sapping effect that that can have, slowing the economy, and the recent economic data, which has been okay, but it's not been great. Yes, unemployment is low, but wages have been falling in real terms. Even if you take out the temporary inflation element caused by the fall in the value of the pound after the Brexit vote, wages haven't really been going up at all for the best part of a decade. We have a productivity problem, which means that we don't manage to make more in the same amount of time. We have a problem with businesses investing. We have consumer debt. We have high house prices. All of these things add together to make a picture that isn't overly rosy. So what's it doing? Well, it's trying to bring down inflation. Now, inflation is at 3%, but it's expected to peak soon. Potentially even it has already peaked because the figures lag and the Bank of England was suggesting it may peak around 3.2% and then fall away. Now, in the scenario we're in at the moment, where much of that inflation is pretty much temporary because of the fall in the pound, as long as the pound doesn't take another big tumble, most of the effects of that fall in the pound have filtered through. Now, they filtered through quite slowly because shops tried to avoid passing on as much of it as they could do, largely to do with the supermarket price war that's also been going on. The oil price tends to feed through fairly swiftly, but now we're seeing petrol prices that bit higher, you're seeing energy bills go up, you're seeing the supermarkets pass on a few more price rises. There was a bit of shrinkflation that went on as well, but most of it has come through, and so the expectation is that it will tail off. So actually, in this scenario, realistically, raising interest rates doesn't actually make too much difference. It might shift the pound up a little bit, which should help squeeze that inflation down. And the bank has said that this rise and the two that it sees coming down the road will be enough to bring inflation back to target. But it had already been saying for most of the past year that actually inflation was going to come back to target anyway. So it feels a little bit pointless in that sense. Having said that, though, I do absolutely think that raising interest rates was the right decision. And I think that we should have raised them before now. Because if you spend the best part of a decade doing something that actually doesn't seem to be working, it might be a good idea to try doing something else.
Well, rise it or raise it they did, but will they keep increasing it? And how fast? We did get hints from Mark Carney, though, didn't we? We'd have a couple of rises in the next, few years?
Exactly, yeah. So whatever does happen in the future, they're saying that it will be slow and they will be, again, these small increments. They're saying, look, don't think that just because we've got a taste for it, we're going to keep going and raising rates all over the place. But I do find it interesting that they're getting all het up about inflation and being off target all of a sudden. And really, that was, looking through the report, the main justification they gave for raising rates. Their target is 2%. They've been below target for years. And they're allowed sort of a little bit of leeway. But, I mean, it's been bumping along near negligible for ages. Now it's at 3% and they're getting all worried. The thing you don't want with inflation is for it to escalate. So what would happen is prices start to rise and workers say, hang on a minute, can't afford this. They go to their employers and say, we need pay rises. That should be easier to do at times of high employment. Your employer can't say, well, fine, we'll go and find someone cheaper. So they asked for pay rises. The cost for companies, therefore, goes up for their payroll. How are they going to pay for it? Well, then they just pass on the costs to their customers. So prices go up again, and so it continues to escalate. That is the fear. But that is not what we have seen. We've seen prices go up, and wages absolutely aren't going up in step. So that doesn't seem to be quite the problem that it has been in the past. I mean, lots of people have been suggesting that maybe they did back themselves into a corner, that it's like saying that you're going to do something really stupid, a big dare, and then if you sort of start to have second thoughts about it, you can't then think, actually, no, because you've told everyone that you're going to do it. And the job of the Bank of England, as much as anything else, is stability. And it does that, one, by setting rates, but two, by just talking about what they're going to do. And they like to sort of give forward guidance, and they like to march around the country sort of giving out little indications. And they've been doing that so much up to this announcement that really, we talk about it as markets have priced it in. Investors had assumed that that's what they were going to do. And so actually, had they not raised rates, that would have caused potentially instability and things to go all over the place. So they sort of had to go on and do it.
I haven't forgotten about household finances, don't worry about it. But I do just want to ask Simon, Mark Carney did say that these are not normal times. Does that mean the whole rate rise game has changed and monetary policy just won't work anymore?
Yes, I think it does, actually. I think that what we're using here is a slightly flawed model for how we act. And this is one of the reasons why I think that we should have raised interest rates at some point between bringing them down to 0.5% and the Brexit vote, particularly as the economy has shown such resilience since then. So, firstly, I think what we need to recognise is that the idea behind raising interest rates, or lowering interest rates as well, is that effectively it's kind of like a really simple supply and demand thing. If you take out a mortgage, the bank effectively creates that money by hitting a button on a computer. And what influences how much of that money they can create is the relationship between the amount of loans they can make on their balance sheet and the amount of equity that they have to hold, in the simplest terms. And in order to expand those loans they're making, they have to pull in more money. Now, the idea behind raising interest rates is that if you raise interest rates, that filters through to slightly higher costs for the banks in terms of the money that they need in order to keep on their balance sheet so they can keep making these loans. And they then pass that on to the customers. And because the price of something has gone up slightly, the demand for it goes down. So the price of the mortgage goes up a bit, and all the people out there in the world thinking I might get a mortgage and buy a house, they think, oh, well, maybe I won't. It's a bit more expensive now, so the demand goes down. And it works the other way around if you cut interest rates. Now, the difficulty is most of the people with the money in this country nowadays don't have mortgages. Or if they do have mortgages, a lot of them tend to have quite small mortgages and possibly not be intending on moving as well. And so it's been widely documented, particularly by the ONS, about how wealth now largely sits with an older generation who tend to be asset rich, largely to do with their property, but maybe also to do with their pensions. They might have more disposable income coming in from final salary pensions, from the fact that they've actually paid off their mortgage, so they don't have big mortgage payments to make. They might not carry the same commuting costs that people who work do. Whereas actually the people with the mortgages, this sort of younger families with the mortgages, tend to have less money. And so you have this scenario where the people with the money aren't spending the money. I know loads of people like this, of my parents' generation, the generation below it, who actually have large amounts of money compared to the younger generation, wandering around complaining about the fact that they don't have any money and they aren't earning any interest on their savings. And that means that they don't go out and spend money. So actually, one of the knock-on effects of cutting rates has been that lots of those people have spent less money. And in fact, they've just saved harder. Because they're getting no return on their savings, they've actually just saved harder. Now, the Bank of England's argument has been, yes, this has been terrible for savers, but look at the returns on the stock market. You know, if you'd have been invested, you'd have got all these returns. But of course, lots of these people aren't invested. Lots of these people just hold cash. And actually, the lower rates dampen their spirits. And then you've got the issue with potentially the property market, which is a major driver for the UK economy. And actually, the big issue there for most people is not the mortgage payments. Mortgage payments are actually, because of ultra low interest rates, very, very low if you compare them to rent in particular. Mm. The problem they have is the fact that because house prices are so high, that they need to get a huge amount of money to move up the ladder one step. And then they might have to pay a whacking great chunk of stamp duty on top of it. So actually, the levers that we're pulling to do with interest rates aren't pulling the same things that they used to pull 10 years ago, 15 years ago. There are now only 25% of households, I think, that actually have a mortgage. And that's down substantially from about 35% in 2004. And all of these things mean that I don't think stuff is working quite how it's meant to be working. And that actually you could find yourself in the scenario where raising rates increases the confidence amongst those people and they actually go out there and spend a little bit more money.
Rachel, your thoughts?
I find it a little bit hilarious. For so long, we had bankers, central bankers were like gods. The logic with which they made these decisions that affect all of our lives was seen as absolutely set in stone. And there's just so much of it that is crumbling. Things that are supposed to work that don't work. And our response to it so often just seems to be to give it a funny new name and move on. We talk about secular stagnation. So that's global growth is slowing down. Rates around the world, it's not just in the UK, but around the world, interest rates are super low. And still, people aren't spending. That's what's supposed to happen. You lower rates, everyone goes a bit berserk. Not the case. Low growth, low rates. What's that about? And so we sort of look for different narratives. Maybe it's about automation, or maybe it's a general global aging population. But it's just that there is a breakage in that assumption. And then there are other ones like, because we've got near full employment, wages should be going up, but that's not happening either. We've got uncertainty that should be causing people to stop spending. Low wages should also do the same thing. Not happening either. There's a lot that needs to be rethought. And a lot of it, I think, comes down to, as Simon says, things not being as they were, assumptions not holding true anymore. And also, and what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago with Richard Thaler, people are weird. And all the economy is, all that any of this stuff is people. And we don't necessarily follow these rules. We don't necessarily stop spending because we've got no money.
No, indeed we don't. Well, let's go on to that and how we're spending our money and how this will affect our household finances, those decisions that are made, the 0.25% rise. For almost half of those people who have a mortgage, it'll be the first time they've ever seen the interest rate go up. Now, the losers in all this will be those with tracker rate mortgages, 1.4 million. We'll see an immediate rise in payments of around £216 a year. That's for an average £150,000 loan. Those with a standard deal, that's about 2.3 million more people. They'll see their rates go up at the start of December. Also, debtors will be hit. Some rates on credit cards and loans set to go up. The winners could save us, dare to dream of better times ahead. But let's do the bad news first, shall we? Rachel, mortgages, trackers particularly first.
So trackers, anyone on a tracker, they're the first who are likely to see an increase in their rates because trackers just bob along on top of the Bank of England base rate.
Have we seen it already?
We have seen already, even on fixed rates. We started to see it last week with preemptive strikes by some of the biggest lenders. HSBC did it, Santander, NatWest, they all went for it, got rid of some of the super best rates already gone.
In fact, there was a stat out, just to interrupt briefly, that I saw the other day, that 84% of mortgage lenders had already raised interest rates, their interest rates on new mortgages before the decision came in.
So that's the trackers. Fixed, if you're locked in, you're safe for a while until it comes to an end. When you next come to remortgage, you might not find that you have quite as good a rate as the one you were on before. And anyone who's looking to fix now, you probably can't get as good a rate as you could have done say a month ago, but they are pretty good. And even actually, say you're coming to the end of a five-year fix and you want to go on to a new one, you will still probably get a better rate now than you would have done 5 years ago.
I'm wondering, now initially may not have a huge impact, particularly anyone who's fixed, but is there going to be a problem? And I know that we had the new lending rules which are a bit stricter, so they should, in theory, people should be okay. But if we can have a problem in maybe 2, 3, 5 years' time when a lot of these people who've never seen an interest rate rise will sort of take a look up and go, whoa, the environment's really changed.
You would hope that a fixed rate gives you a little bit of breathing space to think about what's going to come up and hopefully to plan for it. That's one thing. Two, if house prices continue to grow, people might be saved by having paid down debt, seen house price appreciation, maybe they'll get in a better loan to value, so that could help as well. Three, as we said earlier, rates probably not going to go up too much more over the next couple of years. But, I mean, even in the short term, so it's a few quid. Say on an average 200 grand mortgage, 25 years left, on 4.5%, which is kind of average for a variable, if that's going up to 4.75%, then that's an extra 330 quid a year. It all adds up, doesn't it? If you've got inflation at 3%, your mortgage on top of that, right before Christmas.
Yeah.
And you haven't had a pay rise in 10 years. Everyone who announces price rises say, it's just another £2.50. Thank you very much, Virgin Media. But it all tots up, doesn't it?
I heard someone say, someone who's sort of used to these rates that we were talking about a little bit earlier, when Yaz was at number one, saying, oh, welcome to the real world. You're laughing there, Simon.
I'll tell you what, anybody from that generation who wants to tell me that, I will gladly swap and go back there and take the much lower priced housing that they benefited from back then that was much closer to relationship with wages. And I'd also take the profits that was made on that property over the past 30 years as well, because I actually think that we would be much better off in a world where interest rates were higher and house prices were considerably lower.
Well, talking about house prices, there's been a load of speculation after that decision as to how it would impact there. Now, rising interest rates tend to dampen the property market, pushing up mortgage rates, knocking a little bit of confidence. Is this what we're expecting to happen? And so what timescale?
I don't really think that a quarter point raise is going to make much of a difference to the property market.
But then beyond that,
beyond that, it will do. And the important thing is not this first rate rise. As has been pointed out repeatedly, this merely takes us back to the point where we were before the Brexit vote and where we had managed to survive for a very long time. Is what happens next to interest rates. And in the impenetrable report that Rachel so kindly translated, there are a number of charts and tables. These are the real dynamite, because they show how the Bank of England thinks that the bank rate, as it calls it, its official name, or the base rate as most of us call it, will rise. And this one covers basically the next 2 to 3 years. Now, there's a slightly circular thing going on here, because it effectively is saying this is how it sees bank rate rising based on what the market thinks is going to happen to bank rate. Now, of course, what the market thinks is going to happen to bank rate is largely driven by what the Bank of England is doing and saying. But the Bank of England is saying, well, if we raise it like this, then we think inflation will come down like that. So it goes round in circles. So these things can change. Don't take this as gospel. But in yesterday's report, and also brilliantly, what increment does the base rate normally move up in?
0.25?
Yeah.
Or 25 basis points?
So it was 0.25. It's gone to over half. Next move is expected to be 0.75. Brilliantly, in the Bank of England inflation report, it refers to it in round numbers. So you get 0.6, 0.7. Anyway, the end of 2018, bank rate is forecast to be 0.7%. So you need to round that one up. It shifts from 0.6 to 0.7 around the middle of next year. So banks saying it expects another rate rise in the middle of next year. 2019, it then sees between the third quarter and the fourth quarter, 0.8 then to 0.9. So that is when you might expect it to move up to 1%, and then doesn't see rates rising at all in 2020. Could that happen? Mm-hmm. If everything turns out as the Bank of England predicts in its report, then that could happen. Or if everything doesn't turn out like that, it could just still happen anyway. But here's three scenarios for you: the good, the bad, and the awkward. The good scenario is everything goes better than the Bank of England thinks. People start to get pay rises. The economy grows faster than we think it's going to grow. Inflation comes down nicely, perhaps even quicker than we think it's going to come down. Brexit negotiations go swimmingly. Businesses are investing. The consumer and retail figures, everything there looks healthy. We build more homes. Everything goes well. But at that point, actually, even though inflation has come down, what you're probably going to see is the Bank of England start to think that it can raise interest rates that little bit quicker. Because in the back of the Bank of England's mind will be the knowledge that at some point in the future there's going to be a recession. And the more rate rises you can get under your belt before that recession comes, the more firepower you've got to deal with it. So that's the good scenario. And that's good because basically it means that interest rates are going up because the economy is doing well. And yes, that's going to mean a little bit more pain for mortgage borrowers, but hopefully it will keep house prices down. And high house prices are not a good thing, folks. And it will reward savers, and we can all have a smile on our face. The bad scenario: things don't go so well. Brexit negotiations, they turn out to be a real pig. and businesses stop investing. Banks saying they're going to move their headquarters away from London. Wages remain stagnant. Businesses stop investing, consumers stop spending. Maybe we even see a recession. I mean, between now and 2020, there's every chance that we could see a recession. Mm-hmm. Now, in that bad scenario, what's going to happen to interest rates? Well, they're not going to rise at the rate that the Bank of England is forecasting there. In fact, they probably won't rise at all. If we see a recession, they might even get cut. And then there's the awkward scenario. The awkward scenario is just that Brexit turns out not that the negotiations go well or that they go badly, but they're just really, really awkward. And inflation doesn't come down. It stubbornly sticks up towards that 3% level. We don't see any productivity growth. Wages kind of just stick to this sort of slow grind down in real terms. So it's not bad, bad, but it's definitely not good. It's just awkward. Well, what does the Bank of England do then? That's when the Bank of England has a real problem, because it's going to have to find out where the middle ground lies between what it's forecast happening to interest rates and not really wanting to cut them, with the knowledge that inflation hasn't come down, so they really now need to be trying to do something about it. So there you go.
So if anyone thought the crystal ball was murky before, thank you, Simon, for pointing that out. And I would like to say, savers, we have not forgotten about you.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings, backed by HM Treasury.
So who are the winners? Well, banks, who are set to net $500 million in the next year. Mark Carney, who's shaken off that unreliable boyfriend tag. Retirees as payouts on annuities, which pay a pension income for life. They've risen too. But what about savers? Terrible time of late. Surely, surely, an increase in the base rate will be welcome news for them. However, I'm sorry, while we've spoken about mortgage rates increasing immediately after the announcement, it seems the big name banks have, so far, yet to pass on the benefit. HSBC, Barclays, Royal Bank of Scotland all say they are reviewing the interest earnings on savings accounts. So, Rachel, in theory, good news. In practice, they may have to wait a wee while for an exciting increase.
Well, because the problem is, why do they offer you money to hold on to your cash? To give you some kind of incentive to do it, otherwise you wouldn't bother, you'd stick it under your mattress. But if they don't have to offer you any incentive for you to keep your money with them, why on earth would they bother? So that's why we've seen so many savings rates are at, what, 0.1%? I mean, totally rubbish, pathetic, embarrassing, and I think pretty disgraceful.
Offensive.
And if that's offensive. Mm. And Mark Carney said, look, we really do expect you to pass on this rate rise to savers. But if they have no reason to do it, they're not going to necessarily bother. So we might see over the coming months a nice flurry of activity in new savings accounts. That's where they have to work to get your custom, because from the top of the Best Buy tables, you must be a more active saver, you're shopping around. But the incumbents, those who haven't moved their savings in a long time, don't expect that just because the rate's gone up, you're going to see an increase to your savings rate as well. Go on to thisismoney.co.uk/savings. Get a better rate.
Better like what? And also, is there a concern as well about getting fixed rate, that by the time that's over, that the rates are going to have gone up? So actually, what do you do at the moment? What's out there with which you should be looking at?
It's really difficult. I mean, rates have gone up a bit over the past few months, which we haven't seen for ages. That's a little bit exciting. So you can get an ISA 1 year for about 1.3%. It's a bit better than it was, at least. You can fix for in a 5 year bond for about 2.7%, I think it is. You might notice here that none of those numbers are higher than three.
Yeah.
So regardless of what savings account you put your money in, it will be eroded every day, worth a little bit less. It's really hard to work out what to do, to stick it in a 1 year, stick it in a 5 year, depending on what you see inflation doing, what you see rates doing. There is definitely an argument that if you can afford to shovel your money away somewhere and hide it for the next 5 years, could you consider investing it? If you don't need it over that kind of time scale, and you feel happy taking a little bit of risk, might be a time to do it, just because at least then you might stand a chance of beating inflation, of your money not being eaten away at.
I'm wondering if this environment, though, has caused a bit of concern for the fact that there's been some research suggesting a quarter of us just don't have any savings whatsoever. And like you said, at that 0.1%, you kind of think, well, what is the point? But actually, if we get the good, the bad, the awkward, this could leave people really struggling should they need that sort of emergency buffer. I mean, we had the FCA report a couple of weeks ago saying half the population are financially vulnerable.
That is really the other side that's worth talking about. That's very easy to say, you know, bad for people with mortgages, good for people with savings, but there'll be millions of people who don't identify with either of those categories. They're just totally skint and in a lot of debt. Yes, that's going to be a big problem. We've got £208 billion of unsecured debt between us. £70 billion of that is credit card debt. As soon as the cost of that starts to go up, people are going to struggle to, yes, with servicing those loans, but also as their disposable income shrinks as a result, that's going to be a problem. I mean, the only thing that you can really do is pay it off as quickly as you can, and the biggest stuff first, the stuff that you're spending a lot of money trying to service that debt, try and get rid of it. But I know it's easier said than done.
So we've already seen the cost of credit go up to a 10-year high, to the average of 23%, I think it is.
On credit cards, yes. Mm. I mean, lots of people are kind of sheltered from that by locking into these incredible deals. Yeah. Zero balance transfer.
We're already seeing some of the best go.
And they are starting to go. And lots of people have just been surviving by switching every time their introductory period ends, switching to another one. But the music will stop.
So before it does, make sure you use those wisely if you are, Simon. To end on a positive note with this one, though, you have penned your latest article. It is entitled, Three Ways to Get Richer Whatever Happens Next with Interest Rates. I feel like you should be on a stage in America giving this really big speech about how you can get rich anyway. So, Simon, the stage is yours.
Okay, so there's a caveat here. This does rely on you actually having some money in the first place.
I did say how you can get richer, though.
Yes, exactly. But for a lot of our readers, three things that they can do. First one. Think about switching your mortgage. Now, there's an awful lot of people paying standard variable rates. These are the rates that you fall onto after a fixed rate deal or tracker rate deal ends. The bank can move it up or down at any time, and they're expensive now. And there's no real reason to be paying one. You can leave for free in that instance. At least just go and see. I can't be bothered. I'll have to do all the paperwork. They're not great excuses. Go to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgage-finder, put in your details, and it will tell you the cheapest rate that you can apply for, and then you can at least have a good think about whether it's worth saving a few hundred pounds, potentially a month. Savings rates. Go and look at where all your money is and all those different savings accounts that it's ended up in over the years, and all those rubbish ones that banks are paying you terrible rates on, which I will highlight one in a minute. Move your savings into places where you get a better rate of interest. It's better to have a pretty good, pretty rubbish savings rate than a really, really rubbish savings rate. And also look at your investments. So if you do have an investment portfolio, they tend to drift a bit. You add this investment trust here, that fund there, buy that share that you think's a good opportunity, and it tends to drift away from what you need, what can achieve your goals, just becomes a bit messy. You shouldn't tinker unnecessarily, but once a year you should sit down and reassess it. And what you should do whenever I think in order to evaluate any kind of active fund, you know, whether you're paying a fund manager, is you should look at that and say, is this doing something better than a cheaper alternative tracker fund could do? And if you think it is, then yeah, that's great. But if not, go get that cheaper alternative tracker fund. And one final thing on savings rates in particular. Now, I don't like picking on individual banks. Actually, that's a lie. I love picking on individual banks.
All right.
And the one I've decided to pick on today is NatWest. Now, I went onto NatWest's website while we were talking just now, and I flicked through to savings and to products that are available. And I have discovered one of the two instant access accounts that it is offering. So this is for new customers. Mm-hmm. The Instant Saver. Instant Access Savings Account. Full details. Now, what do you think the interest rate on this little winner is? Is this one of those ones paying 0.25%? Is it one of those ones paying 0.1%? I don't know. Or is it one of those real insults paying 0.05%?
I just hope whatever they've done... Do you remember when they had the ISA rates and they were going, countdown to the ISA?
Sadly,
and
there's no countdown on this one. The rate on this is 0.01%.
No.
So there is actually a savings account here that pays so little interest that it's almost pointless it paying any interest. 0.01%. And in this table, there's this brilliant tab that you can click on, and it says, decide if it's right for you. I mean, what kind of decision tree do you follow where you end up going, oh yeah, 0.01% savings account, that is right for me? People, don't accept this rubbish. Don't ever put your money into a savings account like this. Don't ever allow your money to end up sitting in a savings account like this. If you have a savings account like this, or if you ever think about putting the money in a savings account like this, don't. Just go put it somewhere else where someone will pay you some interest rather than insulting you.
I can't work that. So that's a new one. Did no one sit around from NatWest and go, do you think this just looks a little bit bad? Like, should we not?
I've also seen that they are alerting their customers this morning to the increase in the base rate, explaining that they will be in touch in due course about what that means for mortgages.
I'm astonished. You're right, Georgie. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I'm absolutely astonished that in the whole of the organisation that is NatWest, now bear in mind that this is a bank that is still largely owned by the UK taxpayer, not one single person has said, I don't think that we should offer a savings account that pays 0.01%.
Yeah. We sort of hinted at better times ahead for savers, and then we dashed their spirits, and we're going to do it again. So I'm really sorry. But actually, let's move on to a joint investigation by your good selves and your sister publication, Money Mail. Now, this has laid bare what you're calling the government's shameful betrayal of savers who are desperate to boost their state pensions. Rachel, explain.
It's a complicated one, but HMRC have not been helping. So they've got this system where if you don't have quite enough number of years of national insurance contributions and you want to get your full state pension, you can top it up. Brilliant. It's quite a good deal. Tanya Jeffries has had people, readers, getting in touch with her saying, we did that. We bought our extra bit. And it turned out that we didn't qualify. And so HMRC has gone and cashed their checks, taken the money and, well, not run, and given them absolutely nothing in return.
We covered a case, actually, on this podcast a couple of weeks back. Do listen. John and Jan Airy, wasn't it? They'd paid £7,000 for a state pension.
£7,000.
And they proved worthless. I think they got their money back in the end thanks to the work of you guys.
Well, exactly. Tanya's been getting the money back for readers, and HMRC after this joint Money Mail investigation did say that they admit that they haven't got things right and they'll be going back to other people. But this is the next step for Tanya, is finding out how they're going to get in touch with those people and making sure that they do. Mm. And since then, she's had lots of other readers getting in touch saying, yes, this has happened to me as well. But it's a complicated system anyway. Then the guidance from HMRC around it has been even more complicated. And then they're just taking people's money and giving them nothing in return. Or what they do is they say, well, you might not get this increase in your state pension, but there are other things you get. You get bereavement benefits. But they're saying this to people who, one, that's not what they went out to get in the first place. And in other areas of financial services, sometimes we call that mis-selling. I mean, you know, when you take out a packaged account and it gives you stuff like travel insurance, although you never travel, or car insurance, though you don't have a car, the regulator has seen a problem with that. So anyway, they're saying, well, look, you do get this benefit of bereavement payments, but they're saying this to people who do not have loved ones who would benefit from it should they sadly pass away. So it's nonsense, and hopefully it's being fixed. But really, thanks to Tanya Jeffries and Money Mail as well.
Well done, both. If anyone has been affected by this or they've got anything that you'd like to investigate, where should they go?
Email us. Love getting emails. editor@thisismoney.co.uk.
Fabulous. Now, if house price figures are possibly my most hated financial topic, not that I don't like talking about houses and property and that, like, it's just the figures. They're all over the place. There's so many that come out. But what comes a close second is Bitcoin. I'm going to be totally honest. I've read a couple of books about this and I still don't get it. But this is not about me. This is about one of your readers, again, far more informed than I on the subject, who's written to you. This is the reader, not I. I'm a basic rate taxpayer employed in IT, and by an amazing bit of luck, I bought 1,000 bitcoins in 2012 for a fiver each. I've now been told they're worth more than £4 million at the current exchange rate. As this is a virtual currency, does that mean I have to declare the sale for tax purposes? I've been told any gain is tax-free because the money doesn't really exist in tangible form. Woo! Fiver each. They're worth £4 million.
More.
More?
I mean, that was a few days ago, Georgie.
Goodness me.
Gone up since then, yeah.
That's literally how much that's some rate of investment, isn't it?
Can you imagine?
No.
Lower rate taxpayer, and they just decide to take a punt on this absolute bonkers investment.
So this is genuine. He's now actually £4 million richer.
Well, in theory, should he cash it in now? Please cash it in now.
Yeah.
Then yes. But, you know, it's such a kind of volatile currency.
Clearly.
The 4 million now, who knows what it'd be worth next week. But at the moment, yes, he's a millionaire.
Okay, so what? I should go right back to basics. What is Bitcoin? Because some people say it's more like a commodity than a currency.
Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency. Does that help?
No.
Okay, so
go even
Bitcoin
further back.
Is a cryptocurrency built on a thing called the blockchain. And the blockchain is effectively a kind of computer program, and it's a ledger that records all transactions in the past. So if you are Bitcoin minded, you can dive into it and see all the things that's happened in the past. Now, you can use the blockchain to create a number of different things, and there is another system that's grown out of blockchain called Ethereum, which is being used for lots of different stuff. But this particular use of the blockchain was to create a currency called Bitcoin. Bitcoin was created by this mysterious character. Nobody quite knows exactly who that person is who created it. And it has to be mined. And in order to mine it, you need a lot of computing power. So a huge amount of computing power. You couldn't do this on your computer at home. And there's a limited number of these bitcoins that can be mined. So there's a limited number of this that can come into existence. And what has happened over the years is that the price has gone up substantially. Now, has the price gone up substantially because this is actually turning into a proper currency and it is a currency of the future and it's going to replace the fiat currencies that we know and love, the pound, the dollar, the euro? Or is it just a mania? Or is it something in the middle? Who knows? I definitely say that it appears to be more akin to a mania than anything else. There's some debate as to what it even is. Is it a currency? Is it a commodity? Is it just a bet? So should you just not have to pay any tax at all?
Yeah.
But anyway, what the upshot of this is that if you bought some Bitcoin 4 or 5 years ago, and even if you bought a relatively small amount, then you would be sitting on a colossal profit. And in fact, even if you just bought some Bitcoin at the start of the year, you'd be sitting on a big profit because it's gone parabolic this year. It's gone. If you map the Bitcoin chart over the classic bubble chart or the tulip bubble chart or any other bubble chart, it looks a bit similar. And the bit at the end of the chart where it just goes up and up and up and up and up and up into the sky, that's what Bitcoin's been doing. So this scenario where someone has made all this money, there will be people out there like that. The problem is it was quite difficult to buy the Bitcoin in the first place. People have these Bitcoin wallets. There's stories of people losing the Bitcoin wallet. There's all kinds of things that could have gone wrong. So if you've ended up in this position where you actually have that Bitcoin and it's theoretically worth all that money, I'd probably be thinking, everything has gone so right for me in this when everything could have gone so wrong. I probably should cash some of this in. And I'd probably think, how much of it should I cash in that I'm happy that at least I've parked that amount of money? And how much of it am I willing to leave there in the gamble that it keeps going up? But should you pay tax on it? That's the question.
£5,000 to £4 million in 5 years. Cha-ching, I'm in. I'm done. I'm out.
How much more money do you want?
No, it's enough for
me. You do have to pay tax. It's not sort of so airy-fairy, made up of nothing that the tax man doesn't want in. There are two types that you might have to pay. If you do the mining thing that Simon was just talking about, then that's income tax and national insurance, because that's counted as a trade. But if you're just buying them, they exist already, and you're sort of buying them off someone else, that's capital gains tax. And so, yeah, you could be left with 400-something grand, I think, of tax, which sounds astronomical, but whatever, if you're getting
It just surprises me that HMRC couldn't figure out and get on top of this state pension top-up you're talking about. But they are right on it with Bitcoin,
No, they definitely want their, not their tuppence, their, you know.
Even if you don't, even if you don't get Bitcoin, me, is this the future of money? Because it cuts out the middleman, doesn't it? The banks, and they've been heavily criticised, have they not? By your good self in the show, Rachel. Is something akin to this, like where we're going? Because let's be honest, how many of us actually physically touch money? Would it make a difference? Yeah. What goes on in the background doesn't really affect most people, right? We just want to pay for something and be done with it.
All money is just made up notions that we collectively decide exist. I mean, bits of paper that say, I promise to pay the bearer. So long as you believe that that whoever signed it will, then it exists and it's worth something. And then as soon as you start to question and see it as a piece of paper, then the whole system collapses. So the question is, can we end up with a cryptocurrency that people have that much confidence in, that it could end up, you know, at the same kind of status as the dollar or as the sterling? But it does, as you say, raise big questions. We're talking about interest rates. One of the reasons why central banks can do what they can do, you know, pull these levers, push these buttons and influence what happens to the economy, is because we're all spending the same stuff. But if everyone's putting all of their wealth into Bitcoin, then they don't have the power anymore to raise interest rates, or their power is diminished. So that does raise huge questions about the lack of centralized banking.
I think there is an interesting element in this tax question that highlights something that is wrong with our tax system, a very sneaky trick that was introduced to it a couple of years ago. Now, it's very difficult to feel sorry for anyone who has made 3,995,000 pounds worth of profit on something. However, the tax that they would have to pay is capital gains tax. Now, in theory, there's a bit of good news for them there, because they're a basic rate income taxpayer, and capital gains tax was cut to 10% for basic rate taxpayers, but it's 20% for higher rate taxpayers. However, what happens is, despite the fact that capital gains tax is an entirely separate tax to income tax, which is why it is taxed at a different rate, it is taxed on a completely different concept of gain. One is income, one is a capital gain. What you do when you work out which one of those taxes you'll pay is you have to add your capital gain to your income for that year, and if that then pushes you up above the next income tax threshold, you pay the higher rate of capital gains tax. And that is a really, really sneaky trick in our tax system, because those are two completely separate taxes that have just been pushed together so that you have to pay a little bit more. And if you want people to pay their taxes, the tax system needs to be fair. And that is one of the examples where it definitely isn't.
And that is a debate for another show. Editor Simon Lambert, personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our humble podcast, why not rate us on iTunes, tell your friends and family, and join in the conversation.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.